So this is Bio 160, and it is Tuesday, August 26th, and we're kind of in the middle or beginning of the chemistry chapter. And so last time we were talking chemistry, we're going to talk chemistry today. And I think we were looking at some subatomic particles. For instance, there are three subatomic particles that you should be aware of. Is any of this ringing a bell yet? Did we talk about subatomic particles? I think. What are the three subatomic particles we've got to get a feel for? There were protons, neutrons, and electrons. All right, so only three particles. And each of these three particles could be in one part of the atom. And there's only two parts of an atom. So you got to know the two parts of an atom and which particle goes in which part. So can anybody tell me the parts of an atom? The nucleus, great. And orbitals or shells. Furthermore, what kind of particles go in the nucleus? Which one of those three? Protons and neutrons. And in orbitals, which one of those particles? In orbitals, only electrons. No protons, no neutrons. So, in a regular atom, we have the nucleus and we have orbitals. Inside the nucleus, we can have protons and neutrons. In orbitals, we can only have electrons. And this diagram here shows you that an electron has a charge. What kind of charge does an electron have? Yeah, negative, and it's a negative one charge. A neutron has no charge on it, and that's why we call it a neutron. And a proton has a positive charge, one. And that one positive charge exactly balances out the one negative charge of an electron in a nucleus someplace. We also talked about different elements, like we see on the periodic table over here. What makes one element different from another element? Yeah, the very nice way of saying it very simply is atomic number, but you should know what that means. What does atomic number tell you? It tells you the number of protons inside the nucleus. And in this particular case, I see 11 protons inside this nucleus. And then you could look at the periodic table and tell me what atom this is or what element this is. Can you use the periodic table to see which one has 11 protons? Okay, looking at the periodic table right here, I see hydrogen has one, lithium has three, and here's one that has the 11, and that's sodium. So there are some chemical symbols that you have to know. You don't have to know all of the names of everything on this periodic table, just the ones that are on your list that's in your book, for instance, potassium and calcium, sodium, magnesium, just the ones that are important for us to stay living with that we need, and chlorine. And anybody else know of a good element that you have to have in your body to stay healthy? Water, hydrogen. There are how many hydrogens in water? Two, right? H2O. Ah, there's another one, which is what? Oxygen, that's symbolized by O. But what's kind of a rare one? Potassium. Yeah, potassium is with a K. Calcium, did you say? Calcium is a good one to know. Our bodies need a little bit of iodine to make a thyroid hormone in our neck. Just a little bit. Guess what the chemical symbol for iodine is? That's I. But it's easy to confuse with another element that we need a lot more of, iron. So we do need iron. And so the chemical symbol for iron can't be I because I stands for iodine. So who knows what iron is? Fe. Believe it or not, it's Fe. And iron is over right here someplace. How many protons are in the nucleus of an iron atom?
26.
The atomic number is 26. So that's how you would use that chart. So on that first test, I might give you this periodic table right here with the words erased out of it. So you'll have to know the chemical symbols for potassium. And then I might ask you, what's the atomic number for potassium? Well, you'll have the periodic table. You have to know K stands for potassium. And then you find the atomic number right there. So it would be what? What's the atomic number for potassium? 19. It's got 19 protons inside the nucleus. Okay. So that's pretty easy. Okay. I think we looked over this last time. We looked at these three, right? Hydrogen's got one proton, helium's got two, lithium's got three protons inside the nucleus, right? Okay. And we're talking about this because what we're really interested in are chemical bonds. And we're going to see how chemical bonds develop. Well, guess what I have right here? I have one copy of the notes. Pass it back one more row, please. Okay. So, here's one kind of bond. So I'm going to cover this up a little bit. So if we look at this atom right here, and this is an atom because I see the nucleus and I see orbitals, electrons in these orbitals. And in this particular nucleus, there are 11 protons. So what element is this? What atom is this right here? You have to look at the periodic table, find that 11, the atomic number for sodium, and it's got 11. All right, and the way that electrons fill up the orbitals are from the inner orbitals out to the outer ones. The first orbital here, how many electrons do you see in this first orbital? There are two. All right, so the first orbital can only contain two electrons. And then if we're going to add more electrons to this particular atom, then those additional electrons have to go in orbitals that are farther out. So that would be the second orbital. Okay, and if we look at that second orbital, there can be a maximum of 8. And then if there's more electrons, where do they have to go? In the third orbital. If there's more, then they got to go in the fourth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so the first one's got 2, the second one's got 8, the third one's got 8. All right, so if sodium has 11 protons, how many electrons should it have to be neutral? It should have 11 electrons to be absolutely neutral. So let's put those electrons in the orbitals and see where they all end up. So we have 2 in the first one, 8 in the second one, so that's 10, right? 2 plus 8 is 10. So that means that there's one extra electron, can't go in the second orbital, has to go in the third. So we put it in the third orbital right here, and there's only one electron in that third orbital. Well, in order for atoms to be stable, they like to have their very outermost orbital filled with electrons. Right? And how far away is sodium from filling this last orbital right here? There's only one. Right? So it's going to be looking for 70 electrons from someplace to get filled up. That's really difficult. An easier job for this sodium is just to get rid of that one electron. Give it away to somebody that's looking for one. And when it gives away that electron, the outer orbital now has how many electrons in it? 8, and it becomes stable. Right? So sodium is looking to get rid of one electron. And when it does, what happens to the overall charge of this atom? It's got 11 protons, but only 10 electrons, right? 1, 2 plus 8 is 10. So now they don't exactly balance out. We're left over with one extra proton. And so this atom has a charge, an overall charge of plus 1. And a molecule or an atom that has a charge, we call that an ion. So sodium likes to become an ion. So here is a sodium atom. When it gets rid of an electron, it's going to be symbolized by what? Na, because that's sodium, and it's going to become a plus 1, just one plus sign. That's a sodium ion. So that sodium ion gives our body a lot of electrical properties, because that plus is an electrical, electrical charge. And if that sodium is moving through your body, it's an electrical charge. What do we call an electrical charge that's moving? That's actually an electrical current. So our body produces electrical currents because we have ions inside our body. So that's something that you don't really appreciate, but we're very electrical in nature, okay, because of these ions that we have inside ourselves. Okay, well, let's also follow this electron someplace, and let's consider another atom. This one over here that has 17 protons inside the nucleus. Who can tell me what this element is? How would you go about finding what element this is? Periodic table. Look for the atomic number that has a 17. And then you got to be able to translate from the symbol to the English word. So what is that? 17. Here's 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. All right, that is Cl, capital C, little l, stands for chlorine. So chlorine is that atom that we're interested in. So if it has 17 protons in the nucleus, how many electrons should it have in orbitals to be neutral? Should be 17. And we know how to put electrons in their orbitals, right? So 2 go in the first one, 8 go in the second one, so 2 plus 8, that's 10. That means that there's what? 7 left over, so we're going to put 7 in the third shell right here. But in order for that chlorine to become stable, it doesn't want 7 electrons. How many electrons does it want?
8.
It really wants 8. So it's going to look around for somebody that will donate an electron to it. And who do we know? That sodium will, right? So sodium will donate an electron. Chlorine will accept it. It will fill this empty spot right here. Chlorine will be very happy because its outer shell is all filled up. It's very stable. But what about the overall electrical charge of this chlorine right now? Is it going to be neutral? No. It's got one extra charge, and it's going to be negative. So chlorine is going to be symbolized with a little minus sign, like that. So chlorine is also an ion. Any kind of molecule or atom that has a plus or minus sign is an ion. And we said it produces electricity in our body. And another way that we talk about these things in our bodies, in terms of medicine, we call these things electrolytes. Electrolytes. Okay, so here you see a chlorine atom. Sodium and chlorine are electrolytes. L-Y-T-E-S. And so these are real important because they maintain the electrical properties of our body. And if that's really disturbed, we'll die as a result of that. So it's very easy to die due to electrical disturbances of our body, due to these imbalances of electrolytes. So we measure electrolytes in blood all the time. As a matter of fact, you might be working in an emergency room sometime, and there's a patient there who's maybe not doing very well, and a physician is going to say, we need some lights on this person, on this patient right away. Stat, we need some lights on this patient, stat. What does that mean when somebody says, we need some lights on this patient? Should you go find a lamp and shine it on the patient? No, you need to draw some blood and get the lab to measure their electrolytes to find out if they're in a normal range that will maintain life in them. And some of the electrolytes you look at are sodium ions or chloride ions, maybe potassium ions, maybe calcium as well. So now you can see how ions are formed. And once you have these ions, and we look at these electrical charges, sodium being a plus one and chlorine being a minus one, opposite electrical charges attract each other. Okay? They don't repel each other, they attract. Opposite charges attract. And so you have a sodium and a chloride. And when a solution dries up, sodium likes to get close to chlorine because the opposite charges are going to neutralize each other and they'll form a nice crystal. That crystal form is formed because of what we call ionic bonds. And this is how ionic bonds develop. Okay, because this sodium has a plus charge and this chlorine has a negative charge. So now sodium and chloride together will make a very nice pair and will form a very nice crystal. But this is an ionic bond, is a relatively weak bond. It's not strong. It's weak. Because you all know, does anybody know what sodium chloride is? It's just table salt. It's what you have all over your house. Well, not all over, hopefully. But, right, in your kitchen you have table salt that you salt your food with. If you take some salt and put it in water, what happens to it? Does it just stay like a little rock? No. It dissolves very easily. So that's because this ionic bond is so weak, just by putting it in water, that ionic bond breaks. Okay. So just by putting it in water, ionic bonds are so weak that they will come apart, and then sodium and chloride will be in solution. All right, so those are ionic bonds. Another kind of bond that we're interested in is what we call a covalent. Oh, but I tell you what, let's do just a little synopsis on this ionic bond. How would you talk about an ionic bond? in terms of electrons, what is happening? When one atom loses an electron and another atom gains an electron, that's an ionic bond. That's the some of the key terms for answering or saying something about an ionic bond. An electron from one atom is lost, and that electron is gained by another atom. Loss and gain of electrons. Okay, so for covalent bonds, another kind of bond. So we're looking at this sheet right here. We talked about ionic. You said it's weak. That's when one atom loses an electron and another accepts or gains that electron. That's what? Ionic bond. So now let's look in terms of a covalent bond. What the heck do they look like? Okay. So we actually know a lot of stuff already. So let's see what we have here. Here I have an atom, and here I have an atom. They're two separate atoms. And I tell you what, tell me what atom is that? That's hydrogen, because if you look at the periodic table, it only has one proton, and the atomic number is 1, and that stands for hydrogen right there. Right, so that's a hydrogen atom. And how is hydrogen symbolized in terms of English letters? H, right? There it is right there. So here we have two hydrogen atoms, and how many electrons should be in the outermost shell for it to be stable? Okay. Well, how many could be there? Two, right? And remember, atom is most stable when its outermost shell is completely filled with as many electrons as possible. So there could be two in this first one, but there's only one, so it's going to be looking for an electron. And in this particular case, this other hydrogen atom over here is in the exact same position, right? So we have two hydrogen atoms. This atom is going to be looking for an electron. This one is going to be looking for an electron, so that they both have two. Well, they can come together and share these two electrons together. And when that happens, we draw the diagram that looks like this. This now becomes a hydrogen molecule. And these two electrons sometimes are over here, and sometimes are over here. So both of these nuclei right here actually feel as if they have two electrons in their outermost shell. And so that's a very nice chemical stable situation. And when, so this is a bond, and when this kind of bond forms, it's relatively strong. We don't call it an ionic bond because I don't see any ions right here, because how many plus charges are there on this molecule? Two plus charges, one from this nucleus and one from this nucleus. And how many electrical charges are there? Here and here, there's two, right? And so now we don't see any mismatch in electrical charges. We can't call that an ionic bond. This is what we call covalent. These electrons, the valence electrons, are sharing one big orbital around this whole molecule right here. And so that's a strong bond. So how about if we build another molecule? So this is a molecule of hydrogen. Now, what's the difference between an atom and a molecule? What does a molecule have that an atom does not have? Yeah, a molecule is just something that's made up of more than one atom. It's got to have two or more atoms. So this is two atoms of hydrogen, so we don't really call that an element or an atom, we call that a molecule. Let's build another molecule. Actually, we're going to build a couple. Let's build this one right here. What kind of element has 8 protons inside the nucleus? That would be oxygen, right? So the atomic number is 8. So let's fill up the orbitals. The first orbital or first shell has got 2. Right, so that means so there's 6 left over, right? 8 minus 2 is 6. So the 6 remaining electrons will go in the outermost orbital right here. But how many should be in this orbital? 8. So it's going to be looking for 2 electrons from someplace. And guess where it can find an electron from? Just like over here, hydrogen is willing to share an electron. So if we take two atoms of hydrogen, and you can see this is hydrogen because there's one proton inside the nucleus, it's willing to share one electron. Oxygen is willing to share one. The other atom of hydrogen is willing to share an electron, and oxygen is still willing to share one more. So there are two covalent bonds associated with this oxygen to form H. How many H's?
Two.
H2O. And that's really what? That's a nice water molecule. Okay, so we have two water molecules. Kind of looks like Mickey Mouse ears, but that's a water molecule. And that's kind of how it likes to exist. It's not a nice straight line, but it's kind of bent like that. Okay. And these bonds are kind of springy. They spring a little bit. So has anybody ever seen a tuning fork? This is not particular to this class. Anybody seen a tuning fork? All right, it's like a fork, but it has two prongs on it, and if you tap it, it vibrates at a particular frequency. Well, when you look at this water molecule, to me, it kind of looks like a tuning fork. These are the two molecules sticking up over here, and they vibrate back and forth like that. They don't break the bonds, but they vibrate. And does anybody know what frequency that is? They vibrate. That's a microwave frequency. So when you stick water in a microwave and turn it on, guess what happens to those water molecules? They get all excited and they start vibrating, and when they vibrate more like that, the temperature increases. Okay, so that's just something interesting. All molecules are vibrating all the time. Okay, so that would be another example of what kind of bond?
Covalent.
Now, what's the best way to talk about covalent bonds in terms of electrons? Bonds are always having to do with electrons, and somebody said sharing of electrons, that's perfect. Right, that's a nice perfect synopsis of what's going on here. It's when two atoms will share a pair of electrons. Okay. This molecule over here, you can take a look at in your book. Sometimes you have single bonds, and other times you can have double bonds. So here is a covalent bond. And every single bond is when a pair of electrons are being shared. But in this particular case, how many pairs of electrons are being shared? One pair, two pairs, so we would call this a double bond. And so an oxygen molecule is made up of two oxygen atoms, O2, that's what we breathe in our bodies, and these two come together and it makes a double bond, so it's sharing two pairs of electrons. And a triple bond, there's such a thing as a triple bond. How many electrons are shared in a triple bond? Three pairs of electrons instead. To fill up, to make it seem as if this outer orbital here is filled with the electrons. All right, so that's bonds. We talked about weak ones, ionic. Covalent bonds are strong. Now, if you take oxygen, which has a covalent bond, and we put oxygen in water, is just by putting it in water strong enough to break those bonds? It's not. Only ionic bonds, only some ionic bonds. And that's really good because in your body you have all kinds of chemicals that are put together with covalent bonds. And if we put all those chemicals in water, then you know, what would happen if they were weak bonds? Your whole body would just dissolve away and we'd just be a puddle on the floor, right? So it's good to have covalent bonds so that our body, right, stays together in certain spots. Okay. Kind of a weird way of looking at it, but that's okay. The last kind of bond that we're going to talk about is a hydrogen bond. And this is the very weakest kind of bond. Let's see if I can show you how hydrogen bonds come into being. I think I might have to draw some. Well, I'll show you this one right here. This is a good place to start. Okay, so here is H1, H2, and an O, which is H2O, that's water. Where do we see a lot of electrons? Which of these nuclei, there are three different nuclei in this molecule, which one is surrounded by a lot of electrons and which ones are not surrounded by a lot of electrons? So first tell me which one is surrounded by a lot of electrons. So here, yeah, so here's that oxygen and look, it's surrounded by all these electrons. So this nucleus has a tendency to pull these two electrons and these two over to it. And in so doing, this part of the molecule looks pretty negative. because it has all, it's surrounded by all these electrons. And the hydrogen parts of this particular molecule are missing some of these electrons out over here and over here. They don't like to be in this part of the water molecule because they're all drawn to the oxygen. So if you walk upon the water molecule from this direction, what kind of electrical charge do you see first? You see a positive. So this end of the water molecule is kind of positive, and this end is kind of positive, and this one is kind of negative because of all these electrons right here. But if you look at this water molecule from far away, right, it looks neutral. Water is neutral. But if you get real close, depending on what end of the water molecule you look at, you see that it has a little electrical charge. And since these two ends of the water molecule are different, we call this molecule polar. Just like the planet has, our Earth has different poles. There's a north pole and a south pole in terms of magnetism. This water molecule has different poles in terms of electrical charge, or sometimes we call that electronegativity. This is the negative area, this is the positive area of water. I don't have another good diagram, but this is such an important concept. I'm going to talk about it a little bit. Okay, so if we put a couple water molecules together, like in a glass of water, we see that there is a lot of structure associated with water. And I guess I am going to write on the board. So water, even though it's a liquid, has a lot of structure associated with it, and you could probably see why that is. So electrical charges, what could you tell me about opposite electrical charges? Do they repel or attract? They attract each other. So if we have a water molecule right here, which has a little negative charge, and here these lines are going to represent as covalent bonds. Here is an H. Here is an H. And this end over here are going to be a little what? A little positive. So I'm going to put a little positive charge and positive charge. So if we stick another water molecule in there, and it's going to bump into this one here, how is it going to associate? Is an oxygen going to be attached or be attracted to this end of the other water molecule? Don't forget, oxygen has a little negative sign. So if we put another water molecule, we're going to put the oxygen, which is negative, with a couple more hydrogens this way. All right. And what about over here? Same thing. Another oxygen with two hydrogens. So these two charges are going to attract each other. These two charges are going to attract each other. And this attraction right here is what we call a hydrogen bond. What about this end of the water molecule? What's going to be attracted here? The hydrogen of another one, right? So here is another water molecule, like this, with a negative. So here is another hydrogen bond, just like that. So water molecules, okay, will arrange themselves according to this diagram right here. And this is going to be important physiologically for all kinds of different reasons. And I want you to just think of this question for a second. Is water slippery or is it sticky? Okay. So if there's water on the floor and you step on it, you might slip because it's a fluid. But I want to change your impression about water. Water is actually sticky because maybe you've been out hiking someplace and there's a little pond or a stream or something and you can actually see insects walking right on the surface of the water. Has anybody ever seen that? Mm-hmm. Okay. That's because the insects are so light, they're not heavy enough to push the water molecules apart because water molecules like to stick together. Water really is sticky. It's more sticky than it is slippery. And that property is what we call surface tension. So water molecules don't slip apart from each other very easily. They like to form beads. Okay, they don't just flow very quickly over something. And that's because of all the hydrogen bonds between the different water molecules. All right, so I'm going to go over that later on in the class as well. So water is a polar molecule. It has these electrical charges, and it will act as a good solvent for things that have electrical charges on them. So for instance, if you have a chemical compound that has no electrical charge, that's not polar, it won't dissolve in water. But if you have a chemical that is charged, it will dissolve in water very easily. And we just got done talking about some, yeah, for instance, sodium ions, chloride ions, will dissolve in water very easily because, for instance, here's a water. What would want to get very close to this oxygen right over here? Sodium or chloride?
Sodium,
because sodium has a plus charge, right? So these will want to associate. And what's going to want to be close to the water molecule over here? The chloride. Right? So sodium and chloride dissolve in water very nicely because of those electrical charges canceling out. But if there's another molecule, for instance, like butter, that has no charge on it whatsoever, butter can't dissolve in water because it has no charges. It will just ignore water. And you all probably have a good feeling for that. So, for instance, if you're making some toast this morning and you buttered the toast and it fell out of your hand, how does it always fall? Butter side down for some reason, like right on your pants, right? And you got butter on your pants. Could you just take a wet towel and wipe your pants off? Would that butter come off? No way, right? Because butter has no charges on it. It just will ignore water completely. It just won't, it wants to be around it. So water is polar. Things like butter, oils, gasoline, things like that are nonpolar. They have no charges on them. And polar and nonpolar compounds just will never intermix with each other. Okay. Okay, so that's something about bonds, the hydrogen bonds. So you should be aware of these three different kinds of bonds and be able to rank them in terms of strength. So the strongest one is a covalent bond. What are the electrons doing there? They're being shared. The next weakest is an ionic bond, and electrons there are being donated and accepted. They're going from one atom to another atom. And a hydrogen bond is the weakest, and it's produced because water is a polar molecule. Okay. So I want to just look at a couple definitions right here that are on the sheet. Well, you know a proton, it's got a plus charge. Where do you find it?
Nucleus.
Neutron has no charge. Where do you find it?
Nucleus.
Electron has a negative one charge. Where do you find it? In orbitals. Okay, so nucleus contains only protons and neutrons. Orbitals, only electrons. And what's another name for an electrolyte? An ion, right? It has an electrical charge on it somehow. Here are some examples. Potassium, it's got a plus one. Chlorine, a minus one. And this magnesium right here, and you could actually see why this magnesium likes to give up two electrons. That's because that outer shell has got only two electrons in it. So if magnesium gives those away to somebody, then its outermost shell is going to have eight electrons. It will be stable. So these are all electrolytes or ions. The valence number is the net charge on an ion. So this potassium right here, what's the valence charge of this one?
One.
And magnesium is two. We can have ions that have a three charge on it, for instance, and it can be plus or minus. So we need to also say something about the polarity of these ions, because if we just say potassium is an ion and chloride is an ion, that's not a very good description, because they're really what? They're really opposite. So the way that we talk about whether it's a plus charge or a negative charge is with the following terminology. If it's a plus charge, we call it a cation. All right, so I have this little diagram right here. All right, a cation sort of looks like that. And that's the only thing I ever learned in my organic chemistry class. My organic chemistry teacher drew a cat with little plus marks over his eyes. So cation means it's a positive charge. And the other term is anion. I don't know a nice diagram for that. Somebody could show me a nice diagram for that. An anion is a negative charge. So chlorine is what kind of ion? It's an anion. And potassium is a cation. That's how we talk about it. Okay. Furthermore, these ions can have a plus one charge or a plus two, so when we talk about these ions, we've got to be very particular. So if it's just plus one, that's mono, right? And two is di, or sometimes we say bivalent for two. If it's going to be plus or minus three charges, it would be trivalent. There's some of those ions around in our body. So that would completely describe what kind of an ion these different compounds are, right? So we can have a monovalent or a bivalent or a trivalent. So to talk about magnesium here, exactly to completely characterize what it is, how would you talk about that? It's a, how many, what's the, you say the valence first and then whether it's a cation or an anion. So you would say this is a bivalent cation. And chlorine is a monovalent anion. So that's how you would completely be able to talk about a particular ion in your body in terms of its charge and the magnitude of that charge, whether it's positive or negative. Anybody got any questions on that? Okay. So we saw how those charges develop as well. Okay. Just got a couple little slides. Chemical reactions. We're going to be interested in looking at some chemical reactions, and I want you to know a little bit of nomenclature and how we draw these out. So a chemical reaction is some kind of process by which atoms or molecules interact to form or break chemical bonds. So bonds are going to be rearranged or they're going to be broken, and atoms are going to go to another molecule. So the way that we talk about that is that we write down the chemical equation. For instance, if there's four different kinds of molecules in this chemical reaction, there's molecule A, which is different than B, and molecule B and A is different looking than C, and that's even different looking than D. So these are all separate kinds of molecules. We could say A plus B is going to react to form C plus D. And I have a nice arrow right here showing that this process is going to go from left to right as it's written on this piece of paper. And so everything that's on the left-hand side is what we're going to call a reactant. And everything on the right-hand side of this equation we're going to call a product. So that's just a little terminology. So reactants are A and B, the products are C and D. And we're going to look at some chemical reactions, and I'm going to say reactants are such and such, and so what side of the chemical equation do they go on, the reactants? The reactants go on the left-hand side, and the products go on the right-hand side. Okay, so that's just how we talk about chemical reactions. Some important chemical reactions that we look at, right, for instance, are chemical reactions that maybe produce ATP. What good is ATP? Does anybody know? Energy. Yes, the energy molecule in our bodies that keeps us alive. And when that energy molecule goes away, what happens to the life processes in a body? It stops, right? So ATP is crucial for staying alive. All right, so let me see if I have a picture. Oh, I hope I have a picture. I think I do. Close, but not quite. A picture of ATP. Well, what does ATP stand for? Right here. Adenosine triphosphate. Okay, so what does that tri mean? It's got three compounds of phosphate attached to another molecule that we call adenosine. So adenosine triphosphate has three phosphate groups attached to it. And a phosphate group looks like this. It's not just a simple phosphate element or atom, but it's got these oxygens and these OH groups bound all the way around. So sometimes we call this inorganic phosphate. And so instead of writing this whole big molecule out, sometimes we just abbreviate P with a little sub-I right here that stands for inorganic phosphate, and that's this molecule right here with all those oxygens. Adenosine triphosphate has three of these groups attached to adenosine. And ADP, which is a breakdown product of ATP, has these same groups attached to adenosine, but how many of them?
Two.
Only two, right? So ADP has got two of these groups, ATP has got three of these. And if there's one of these things floating around in solution all by itself, we just call that inorganic phosphate. Okay. So in your book, we have ADP, which has got two of these phosphate groups, plus this one right here floating around in solution. If we can find some energy someplace, we can take this inorganic phosphate and make a join with ADP to become what? ATP, because now it's going to have three phosphate groups. And the energy that's used to do that is going to end up in this molecule right here, ATP. So ATP is a storage form of this energy. It's locked in the covalent bonds that make ATP. Okay, so adenosine DP or adenosine triphosphate. So here is another equation, which is what? The reverse of this first one over here. So we can start with ATP. But what do we have locked in ATP? There is a concept, there is energy locked up in ATP. So if we break off one of the phosphate groups from ATP, it becomes ADP. And that piece that breaks off is this inorganic phosphate. And what's left over? Energy. And that energy can be used to fuel the biological processes inside your body. Like, for instance, what? Muscle contraction. It takes energy to lift a weight up. That energy comes from this molecule right here. So muscles can break ATP down into adenosine diphosphate. So that's where energy for instance, muscle contraction comes from, or energy that you need to maintain consciousness comes from ATP. So that's some examples of some different chemical reactions. The next topic, acids and bases. You're kind of familiar with this. So are acids compounds that are easy to work with, or maybe kind of a little bit difficult to work with? Like if you have a battery in your car that has sulfuric acid, can you like poke your finger inside the battery and swirl it around? What would happen to your finger? You'd pull it out, you'd be missing part of it, right? Because there'd be some chemical reactions there that would dissolve your fingertip away. So knowing something about acids and bases are very important because they control the reactivity of chemical reactions in our body all the time. All right, so let's talk about what an acid is and what a base is. An acid is any kind of compound that's a proton donor. A good example would be hydrochloric acid. And so here is a hydrogen atom and a chloride atom. And we put hydrogen chloride in water, it completely breaks apart because that one electron from hydrochloric acid goes over to chlorine, because chlorine likes to accept the electrons and hydrogen likes to give it away. So now we have this hydrogen nucleus without its electron in solution. So let's see if you can see this. Let's see if I can get a darker marker. So here we have a nucleus, oh yeah, that's nice and dark, with one proton inside of it. And here we have an orbital with one electron in it. What's this atom right here?
Hydrogen.
Right, because that's the atomic number of one. It's got one proton. So that's a hydrogen atom. And if we get rid of this electron, we're just left with the nucleus of hydrogen. And what's this nucleus of hydrogen? What is it really? It's just a proton, right? So sometimes we talk about this thing as just being a proton, and we symbolize this as what? It's H because it's hydrogen, but it's also an ion because it has just a plus charge. It's no longer balanced with this electron. So this thing right here we can call a proton, or sometimes we call this a hydrogen. It's an ion. Hydrogen ion and proton are exactly the same term. And people use these interchangeably for that reason. All right, so what is this H plus right here on your lecture notes? That's a hydrogen ion. It's a hydrogen atom that's missing its electron, which means that it's also just a proton. It's very reactive. It changes the chemistry of the solution that it's in to a large degree. Okay, so that H plus is called a hydrogen ion or a proton. And any kind of chemical that produces these hydrogen ions in solution is what we call an acid. Right? So a chemical, when you put it in water, will be producing hydrogen ions or protons. So sometimes we call that a proton donor, because that's just what that hydrogen ion is. Okay, so there we got a proton. What could you tell me about water? Water is H2 and an O, right? So if we break water down and take a proton off, what are we left with? An O, yeah, an H and an O, but usually we say an OH. We're left with an OH. That's the other particle that we're interested in terms of whether we're looking at an acid or a base. Okay, so let's look at this. A base is a compound that is a proton acceptor, which is the opposite of an acid. A good example would be, what does Na stand for? Sodium, and OH is hydroxide, so sodium hydroxide is a compound. When you put that in water, it completely breaks down as well. So sodium hydroxide in water becomes sodium and this hydroxide ion right here, OH. So OH minus is what we call hydroxide ion. And what can this OH do? It can bind a proton, so we call sodium hydroxide a proton acceptor. So let's just kind of draw this out on... If we have, proton. All right, so if we put hydrochloric acid in solution, it breaks down. And then if we add to this sodium hydroxide, and what's going to happen now? Sodium hydroxide is a base. Hydrochloric molecule is an acid. If we put an acid and a base together, what forms? What is H1, H2, and oxygen? What's H2O? Water. That's water. So if we put an acid and a base together, we just get water and sodium and chloride, which is a salt. And what's the overall charge on this water right here? Do you see an electrical charge?
No.
It's neutral, right? So if we put an acid and a base together in just exactly equal concentrations or quantities, they neutralize each other, right? They just form water. So what's the best way of neutralizing an acid? Pour what on it? Or mix what with it? If you're going to neutralize an acid, okay, you need a base. Or if you have a basic solution and you want to neutralize it, you have to add a acid to it. Okay, and that will just produce water right here. Because water can break down into either a hydrogen ion or a hydroxide ion. So let's just look at these terms once again. An acid is a proton donor, which means it's going to generate hydrogen ions or protons in solution. A base is a proton acceptor because when you put it in water, it generates these hydroxide ions. So that's a nice definition of an acid or a base. And along with this terminology is the concept of pH. I'm going to show you this slide right now, the pH scale. So what is the pH scale? It's a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration in solution. And the pH scale goes from 0 to 14. And what's the number right smack in the middle? 7. And so 7 means that it's neutral. 7 means that the concentration of hydrogen ions is exactly equal to the concentration of hydroxide. They're exactly equal. But as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, it becomes acidic, And as the hydrogen ion concentration decreases and the OH increases, it becomes basic. So that's what those numbers mean. An acid solution has more hydrogen ions than hydroxide. That means the pH number is less than 7. A neutral solution means that hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions are exactly equal. And a basic solution has more hydroxide ions than hydrogen ions. So I'm going to do a little sort of almost like an experiment here with you. So I'm going to erase all of these hydrogen bonds from these water molecules right here. And I'm going to draw a couple beakers. So, and each one of these beakers has water in it. And I'm going to put in some hydrogen ions. And what is this one right here? That's a hydroxide ion. Ooh, I'm making it too complicated, but that's okay. What's the pH of this beaker right here? You should be able to tell me if it's acidic or neutral or basic. And if the number of hydrogen ions, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, equals the hydroxide ions, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, we know this is neutral. Okay, so that's a neutral solution because the hydrogen ions balance out the hydroxide ions. Now let's look at this one here. Here's another solution. Is this one neutral? You see 4 hydrogen ions, but only 2 hydroxide ions. Now, is it acidic or is it basic? It's acidic because you have more hydrogen ions in solution than hydroxide ions, which means it's acidic. You can't tell me the pH just yet, okay, but at least you know this is acidic. What about the third beaker over here? Is it acidic or basic? It's basic because it has a whole lot more hydroxide ions in it. Okay, so that's just what acidity and alkalinity mean, just the hydrogen ion concentration. Okay, so now, are you ready to learn a little tricky part about the pH scale? Okay, you have to just think about it a little bit. As a solution goes from neutral, and we said this is what? Acidic. All right, as it goes from neutral to acidic, what happens to the hydrogen ion concentration? Does it go up or down or stay the same? It goes up. Okay. As the concentration of hydrogen ions increase, the pH number goes the opposite way. It gets smaller. It goes down. And there's just a mathematical equation that we use to calculate pH. I don't want to discuss that in this class, but it has to do with exponentials, and if you were to see that equation and know a little bit about mathematics, it would make sense to you, but probably a lot of people haven't looked at that equation, so I think it would be more complicated to talk about it, and so it wouldn't help you. The thing that you have to know is that if something becomes more acidic, the hydrogen ion increases, but the pH number goes down. It goes from 7 to 6, to 5, to 4, to 3, to 2. Okay, so if you have two solutions with a pH of 5 and a pH of 3, which one is going to be more acidic? 3. And even a pH of 1 is what? Even more acidic. It has more hydrogen ions in solution. So that's the tricky thing. As acidity increases, what happens to the pH number? Goes down, goes the opposite way. So here is kind of a little diagram that's in your book that shows that. Okay, so what's neutral again? pH?
7.
And the area of this red color right here signifies the concentration of hydrogen ions. So this area is really small. This area here is really big. So this means there's a lot of hydrogen ions over here. What's the pH number?
0.
Very small, 0. And as the pH number gets bigger and bigger and bigger, then this area here gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And as this area gets smaller, right? As the hydrogen ion concentration gets smaller, what gets bigger? The hydroxide ions get bigger. So when it's a very basic or alkaline solution, there are hardly any hydrogen ions in solution, but you have lots and lots of hydroxide ions. Okay? So just remember, if something becomes more acidic, look at the pH number. It gets smaller. And as something gets more basic, the pH number gets bigger. Okay, so that's what you got to know about pH. Another important kind of thing, our blood pH in our bodies is about 7.35. Oh, this is a good test. The pH of our bodies is 7.35. So what does that mean? Does that mean that our bodies are neutral in terms of pH, or are we a little acidic on the inside or basic on the inside? A little bit basic, because that number is bigger than 7. That's right. So our bodies operate best at a little bit of a basic nature. Okay. But you know what? We like to eat acids all the time. The pH of Coke, do I have it on this slide right here? It's not here. We don't have it on here? Ooh, too bad. Apple juice, pH 3, that's real acidic. But you know what? The pH of Coke is going to be between 0 and 1. It's very acidic. So if you drink a big Slurpee from 7-Eleven, which is highly acidic, what's that going to have a tendency to do to your body? Make it more acidic. Okay? But this is the pH that we like to operate at. And if during the time you drink that Coca-Cola, if your pH were to drop, say, to 7.20, that probably would be lethal. That would be fatal. So your body can't change pH very much at all. But you eat a lot of acids and bases all the time. So what protects your body? There's got to be something that's protecting your body from those drastic changes in pH. There's a number of things. And the first thing that you'll learn about in this class are compounds that are called buffers. So there are buffers. These are compounds that resist changes in pH when either an acid or a base is added to a solution. That's a buffer. So in our bodies, we have buffers. So if we add an acid to our bodies, our pH doesn't change. Those hydrogen ions get taken up and taken out of solution. Or if we eat a bunch of hydroxide ions, buffers will combine with those hydroxide ions and take it out of our body so it doesn't change our pH. So that's real important. So our pH doesn't change very much, at least over a short period of time. And it's one thing that happens when somebody has diabetes. Their pH can change pretty drastically, and especially if they're a young person, that can actually be very fatal. Right, if somebody has diabetes and they don't know it and their blood sugar is all crazy, not only does their blood sugar change drastically and cannot be controlled, their pH changes as well. Okay, so that would be called a diabetic acidosis. This slide, I don't know if I have this slide in your packet or not, but I've kind of deleted it. So I'm not going to talk about this one. I did a little bit already. I said water is sticky. How could you explain or give me some evidence or a train of thought to show that water is sticky? How are water molecules sticking together? What kind of bonds? What kind of bonds are those? Well, hydrogen will bond to the oxygen by a covalent bond, but what about two different water molecules? What's that bond? Yeah, hydrogen bonds. Very weak bond. So water's not super sticky. It's not as sticky as, say, the molecules that make up this tabletop right here. But every water molecule likes to stick together a little bit to produce that surface tension. Okay. That's the last thing I'm going to say about that. Okay, organic molecules. Let's define organic molecule. It's any kind of compound, and you might have to change your notes a little bit. It's any kind of molecule that contains a carbon atom. So I could just do a quick little test right here. What's the atomic number for carbon? How would you find that out? You would look over at the periodic table, and you know that the chemical symbol for carbon is C, because that's how I have it right here on the paper. Right? And you see that it's got six, is that right? Yeah, it's got six. Okay. So any molecule that contains a carbon atom as well as a hydrogen atom is what we can classify as an organic compound. Organic compounds sometimes are important biologically, at other times they're not. You can have other kinds of molecules in your body that are not organic, but still they're very important biologically. So biological does not necessarily mean organic. Organic doesn't necessarily mean really good unless you're going to the farmer's market or something. Then that has a different connotation. It doesn't tell you what kind of atoms are in that food, it just tells you how it's grown, right? Without pesticides. All right, so let me draw the chemical symbols for this particular compound on the board. What's that element? That's oxygen and that's carbon. So you got CO2. Does anybody know what that's called? Carbon dioxide. Our bodies produce that all the time. We need to excrete that. That's how we partially how we make ATP when we make carbon dioxide. Is carbon dioxide an organic or inorganic compound? It is inorganic because in order for it to be an organic compound, it's got to have carbon plus a hydrogen, and it's got no hydrogens. So this is an inorganic compound. So our body is a little factory that's making inorganic compounds as well. What about H2O? Is that an important compound in your body? Is that an important molecule in your body?
Yes.
Absolutely. Keeps us alive. But is it organic or inorganic? That's inorganic too because it's missing a carbon. So molecules can be very important to us but still not be organic. But in our bodies, there are four kinds of organic molecules that are very important biologically to us. And some of these you're aware of already. The first one on our list right here is a carbohydrate. What's another name for carbohydrate? Does anybody know? Carbohydrate. Carbohydrate is another, it's a fancy term. Actually, it's one of the first terms for sugar. So sugar molecules are carbohydrates. You've probably heard of carbs, right? Now, where does that term carbohydrate come from? It's when we have a molecule that has a carbon. And for every carbon atom in that molecule, what do we have? An H2 and an O. What's H2O?
Water.
So people used to say, well, that's just a carbon hydrate or carbohydrate. And so carbohydrates can have different number of carbon atoms, and that can be symbolized by this little N. If N is equal to 6, right, we just pull the 6 out from this carbon, this hydrogen, and this oxygen, but we could multiply the 6 through there. That could be C6, right, or H12O6. So C6H12O6, all which we have right here, right, that's a good example of a 6-carbon sugar because it's got 6 carbons right here. And an example of a 6-carbon sugar would be glucose. Have you ever heard of glucose? Probably. Okay, glucose is a very important metabolite. For instance, in our blood, our bodies regulate glucose all the time. That's a 6-carbon carbohydrate or a 6-carbon sugar. If your body cannot regulate glucose in the blood, what do we call that? That's a disease process that we call diabetes mellitus, right? That's a very serious condition. All right, so glucose is an example of what we call a monosaccharide. We can put two glucoses together, and that's no longer called a monosaccharide. That's what we call a disaccharide. And if we put hundreds of glucoses together, maybe even thousands of glucoses together, that's what we call a polysaccharide. Okay. And there are two kinds of compounds that are polysaccharides. One is called starch. Starch is found in plants. And the other one is called glycogen. And glycogen is what we find in animals. And starch is a polysaccharide made up of only glucose. So starch is a storage form of glucose in plants. So when you eat starch, what are you really eating? It's like sugar. Yeah, it's pure sugar. It's pure glucose. Okay, can you give me some examples of starch that you might eat in your diet?
Bread.
Rice. Yeah, I forget about rice. Rice is starch. Potatoes. Pasta, because pasta is made with wheat, which is the same as bread. Tacos, right? That's just wheat. That's just what? Sugar. It's just in a different form that doesn't taste sweet because it's just a bunch of glucoses all bound together. Okay. That similar kind of molecule in animals, we don't call it starch, we call it glycogen. Glycogen is a polysaccharide made up of purely glucose subunits. And so glycogen is a sugar as well, but a polysaccharide. We store glycogen in our liver. So when we're in a fasted state and our blood glucose starts to go down, guess what happens? Our liver converts glycogen into glucose. It snips off a glucose and it puts it in our blood, and then that maintains our blood glucose levels. So we'll see some of those things. Right, so you got starch and glycogen are polysaccharides. That's one kind of organic molecule. Another kind, oh, let's see, maybe you do have to know something about this. Okay, here is a pretty good example of a organic molecule. How do you know this is an organic molecule? Because you got carbon and you got hydrogen, right? And if we put some oxygen in there like this, all right, how many carbons do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is a 6-carbon sugar. And I know this is a sugar because of these OH groups right here. So this would be a good example of glucose. Glucose is a 6-carbon sugar. And this thing likes to form a ring. It will bend back by its upon itself and form this ring structure right here. So a lot of times when we see this thing that kind of looks like a stop sign, that would be a nice example of glucose or a monosaccharide. So furthermore, okay, let's look at this diagram right here. Here is just one molecule of glucose. Here are two molecules of glucose. So we would say this is a disaccharide. But what about this molecule right here? That's a polysaccharide. And I couldn't tell you if that's glycogen or starch just by looking at it right here, but it's got to be one or the other because starch is what? Just thousands of molecules of glucose that are put together. Just like that. Okay. All right, the next kind of molecule is a lipid. And we have a number of different kinds of lipids. Sometimes there are fats. And if we look at fats, we can break fat down into this compound right here. What's a fat? Well, a fat has three of these really long chains of carbon and hydrogen. So what do we call this? Is this organic or inorganic? Organic. It's organic. And this thing right here is a fatty acid. And this is a fatty acid. And this is a fatty acid right here. And a fatty acid can be combined with this other molecule that has three carbons on it. So when we have a molecule which is made up of one glycerol plus three fatty acids, we form a chemical compound that you've probably heard of before. So it's got three fatty acids. We call, what's the abbreviation for something that has three parts to it? Like adenosine triphosphate ATP. So here is a triglyceride. Has anybody heard of a triglyceride before? When you get a blood test, sometimes people look at various fats that you have in your body, and triglycerides are one important kind of lipid. Okay? And that's because it's made up of glycerol and these three fatty acids. Okay, that's a triglyceride. And when you look at this part of a triglyceride, do you see any positive charges or negative charges on this fatty acid? No. And none here and none here as well. So because it has no electrical charges, it does not like to mix with water. Right? And so you should know that fats don't mix with water very well. Right? Butter doesn't mix with water, gasoline, oils, and things like that, because they have no charges on them. So this kind of compound we say is it polar or nonpolar? This is nonpolar. Yeah, nonpolar compound. That's an N, nonpolar compound. So lipids are nonpolar compounds. They won't dissolve in water. Some other examples of lipids, okay, will be cholesterol. Is a really good example. I don't know, do I have a picture of cholesterol? I sure do. It's not a nice long chain, but when you look at cholesterol, what do you see? Carbon and hydrogen, right? A lot of carbons and hydrogen, and again, no charges on it, so cholesterol doesn't like to dissolve in water. It likes to dissolve in lipids. Cholesterol, is cholesterol a good thing or a bad thing in your body? Okay. Ah, a little discussion. We need to find out a little bit more about cholesterol. It's bad because if it's at a high concentration, then it produces cardiovascular disease, can plug up blood vessels and things like that. But cholesterol is also important for your body because there are other chemical compounds. Notice that this one right here sort of looks like this one. It has like that stair step little kind of look to it. Other compounds that look like this are important hormones in our body, like testosterone and estrogen. What do we call those things? Those are steroids. Those are sex hormones, right, that regulate sexual activity in us. So these sex hormones come from cholesterol. So if you had no cholesterol in your body, you couldn't make sex hormones like testosterone, estrogen. That wouldn't be so good, right? So having the right amount of cholesterol is very important for controlling sexuality and other things. Even some are called glucocorticoids, like hydrocortisone is based off of cholesterol, and other kinds of hormones come from cholesterol. So you have to have some small amount of cholesterol, but not a lot. If there's too much, that produces cardiovascular disease. Another kind of lipid. So steroids come from cholesterol. Steroids are built off of the molecule cholesterol. Phospholipids. Let's look at a phospholipid. Okay, so a triglyceride. Let's see what a triglyceride looks like. A triglyceride is a glycerol molecule which has three carbons on it and three fatty acids bound to it. That's a triglyceride. Well, we can modify this molecule right here by taking off this one fatty acid and putting on a phosphate group. For instance, this right here. This phosphate, which also has this nitrogen group on it right here. Now, what can you tell me about the electrical properties of this phosphate group? Do you see any electrical charges on it?
No.
It's got, oh, look at this guy right down, with this little one right down over here. So, here's an interesting molecule because part of it does not want to dissolve in water. It is hydrophobic. There are no electrical charges on it. But the other end of the molecule has some. There's one here, and there's actually one out here, which is a positive charge. So this end of the molecule will want to do what? Does it want to dissolve in water or not? It does, because water is polar. A hydrogen on a water will want to come close to this negative, and the oxygen on a water will want to come close to this part of the molecule. So a phospholipid is interesting because part of it wants to dissolve in water and part of it does not want to dissolve in water. So that sounds like kind of an interesting conflict, but it's actually very useful. It's going to build some very nice basic function, very basic structure that actually builds life because of that. And we're going to see how that happens. So we can take this kind of complicated structure and diagram it like this. So here we have this nice circle, which we call a head, and these over here you could call legs, but for some reason we call them tails. Two little tails right here. So this head group is formed by this phosphate. It's water soluble because of that charge right there. So this is the hydrophilic part of the molecule. These long tails right here are insoluble. These are the hydrophobic part of the molecule. Hydrophobic and hydrophilic part. So philic means what? Loving for water. Phobic means? Yeah, afraid of water. So that molecule has those two different parts associated with it. And, okay, I'm just going to say one last thing. about that phospholipid. That's probably a little bit helpful. And then I'll pass back some more quizzes. All right, so what do we got right here? What does that look like? That's a salad dressing bottle. Okay? Okay. So here's the top of the fluid. But what about a salad dressing bottle? What could you tell me about the stuff inside the salad dressing bottle? Is it all uniform? No, there's two separate parts to it. Right? There's two separate parts right here. What part is on the top? Okay, this is the oil part, and the heavier stuff, which goes to the bottom, is the water part. So oil and water doesn't want to necessarily mix up. And before you pour that on your salad, what do you have to do? You got to shake it up, because you just don't want oil on your salad. You want everything that's dissolved in the water, the spices and the salt and tasty stuff is down over here, right? Okay. And then after you pour it on your salad and put it back in the refrigerator, what happens to it? It separates all by itself, or did you have to do something to get it to separate? All by itself. Pretty magical, because this is what? Hydrophobic. This is the hydrophilic part of the salad dressing. All right, so now let's take this phospholipid, right? Here is the philic part, hydrophilic. Here is the phobic part. And let's put this phospholipid in the salad dressing bottle that's in the refrigerator for a long time. Where are you going to find this molecule right here? Is it going to be in the top? Is it going to be down here? Or is it going to be up over here? You know what? It's going to be in the place where I didn't give you a choice. It's going to be right smack in the middle. How so? What part of this molecule is going to be down in the water? The circle part is going to look like be down over here, and what about the tails? Where are they going to go? They're going to start poking up like this. That's exactly right. And do we have to do anything special to get that molecule exactly in that little position right there? It will happen automatically. So now if we put in thousands of these phospholipids, what's going to happen? They're all going to line up just like this. And they're going to create this little structure, right? These phospholipids, and they all line up like that. That's what we call a membrane. And how does that membrane build itself? Anything magical or just happens automatically? It is kind of magical, actually, right? But it happens automatically. Membranes build themselves automatically because they're made up of this compound right here that is part hydrophilic and part hydrophobic. Okay. So I guess that's all I'm going to say for today. So we'll finish up chemistry next time. So that's a really important... we have a quiz coming up, and that's going to be over what? Chemistry. Yeah, the end of the student study guide. So don't forget, you can go back and forth and check your answers at the back of the student study guide. So we will have a quiz on Thursday, yeah. Yes, ma'am. We'll get those quizzes out.